Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. I'm excited about this week's show on Disrespect. I'm even more excited about next week's show. Through a series of contacts, we've unearthed a story, part of which has been playing in the press, about Kaylee Wallace, the brain-damaged child who survives at Sick Children's Hospital. There is a mystery about disabled children like this. Their survival rate in Canada is not nearly that of theirs in the U.S., and it's not because the medicine is inferior. We have a father of a disabled girl to tell the story about why this is happening. This week, in respect of the Conservatives having reintroduced Bill C-51, reducing drug safety in exchange for speed of the approval process, they've changed it to Bill C-6, and it's been reintroduced into Parliament. We have Professor Joel Lextgen talking about the similarities between the Canadian and the American system. Within the Canadian drug regulatory system, democratic values such as openness, safety, and objective information have been ignored as Health Canada consciously opts instead for a drug regulatory system that reflects the interests of private industry, wrote Dr. Lextgen, who teaches in the School of Health Policy and Management at York University in Toronto. His new report has been released, Drug Safety and Health Canada, Gone. Professor Joel Lextgen. Friday, September 22nd, the American Institute of Medicine released The Future of Drug Safety, and today Joel Lextgen reports on Canadian implications for the measures recommended in the American report. Professor Joel Lextgen, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. There are differences between the two countries, but there are also a lot of similarities. The American approval process is somewhat more transparent than what we have in Canada. But the requirements to get approved are essentially the same in both countries. And the fact that the power of the agencies to control medications ends when they approve them is also similar. So that
no ongoing control.
That's right. Except if there are gross safety issues that come up, They can either require modification in the information or negotiate with the companies to get them removed from the market. But neither country, the agencies have the authority to require or to demand post-marketing safety studies.
I understand in Canada there actually are subtle disincentives to monitoring side effects from drugs. There's no compensation for a doctor to take the time to report something subtle, and in fact there may be a disincentive for him to report something major because it involves his judgment and his treatment.
That's true. I mean, nobody is under any obligation to report, except if the drug companies get reports, They have to submit them. But doctors don't have to do it. Doctors often don't recognize side effects. If they do recognize side effects, there is some bureaucracy involved in reporting it. Not an awful lot, but there, as you pointed out, there is no incentive, although I would say that doctors should be reporting as part of just practicing good medicine. But On the other hand, Health Canada doesn't provide any feedback when you do report either. They don't.
Really?
They don't. They'll acknowledge receiving the report, but they don't send you back information about what you reported, whether or not other people have reported the same thing. They don't follow up with you and let you know whether or not they think that what you reported was actually a true side effect. All this, except in cases where it's well recognized, a lot of this is just guesswork. You got got a drug today and a week later something happened to you. Well, was that the drug or was that something else? And
right.
So you file the report, but you're not sure. And Health Canada doesn't let doctors know whether or not what their final decision about that was. They don't. If you file a report on drug A, and subsequently, because of a number of yours and a number of other reports and other evidence, things change with respect to drug A. You don't hear back individually.
Which itself might have been an incentive for the doctors to report, to at least get follow-up.
Yeah. Unfortunately, this is probably a reflection of the lack of resources that Health Canada gives to monitoring drug safety. So if you look at both personnel and money, the branch that approves new drugs gets about five times more money than the branch that monitors the safety, and it has about five times as many people.
I see. Their recommended two steps were reported in the Globe and Mail that were urged by the U.S. report were that consumer alerts be put on labels of all new drugs for a two-year period and mandatory reevaluations of new drugs within a five-year period. Was that the extent of the report's recommendations, or there were more?
Oh, there were a whole series of recommendations with regard to resources to the Food and Drug Administration with respect to getting authority to require post-marketing surveillance studies, with respect to forming partnerships with other organizations that have access to large databases
right.
that can be mined to look for
so sort of sharing information. We have none of these recommendations in Canada, do we?
Back in 2004, the federal and provincial ministers agreed to something called a national pharmaceutical strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the nine items in that strategy was real-world drug safety and effectiveness. In other words, how safe is the drug once it's actually out there on the market?
Right.
And there's been, for the past, about a year and a half, or a little under a year and a half, there's been a federal, provincial, territorial task force looking at the various parts of the National Pharmaceutical Strategy, and one of those task forces has been doing this real-world drug safety. There was a meeting in Ottawa about a year ago now to discuss this with a variety of stakeholders. And there is a coalition of Canadian researchers who have put together a proposal for funding, primarily in academic centers, funding people to examine drug safety, provide feedback to the government.
So there's an initiative in Canada for academic institutions to examine drug safety and feedback to the government, presumably as independent of the drug companies, although...
Yes.
Although the raising of university tuition fees and the crimp in assistance has brought the pharmaceutical companies further and further into academic institutions, hasn't it?
Well, the drug companies, and it's not just limited to the drug companies. I mean, universities are aggressively courting a variety of donors
mm-hmm.
For things like funds for buildings,
mm-hmm.
Endowed shares,
mm-hmm.
things like that. So the drug companies, though, I mean, do have an awful lot of money and may be willing to spend it, although within the universities, you would have to be very wary about conflicts of interest, especially with respect to testing of new drugs and things like that.
Well, I was thinking of Dr. Nancy Oliveri at SickKids,
mm-hmm.
you know, as a prime example of the problem there.
Yeah. The Health Canada initiative, though, may go beyond academic institutions, but it's at this stage, there was just a report, a progress report released, which didn't get an awful lot of publicity. About
when was it released?
Sometime last week.
Oh.
It was about a 30 or 40 page report looking at what was happening with the different aspects of the National Pharmaceutical Strategy.
Right.
Didn't get a lot of publicity, and if you read it carefully, you can't really figure out much of what's happening because it's all in pretty general terms.
Right.
And it's also, nobody's clear either how much priority the federal government is giving to this initiative.
Well, yeah, of course, because we're changing governments like hats lately. And, and I guess each government that comes up wins a minority, so they have to court popular issues rather than issues of conscience.
Certainly true. And this particular issue, there is the potential, at least, for a lot of conflict with the pharmaceutical industry, and it, I don't know where the who the companies give their money to in Canada, but it may be that they give to the conservatives as opposed to give to the liberals, in which case the conservative, if that is the case, and as I said, I'm not don't have any inside knowledge, but the company, the government may be less inclined to confront the industry.
Yeah. You apparently published a research paper last year, which I'm sorry, I haven't had time to familiarize myself, but you surveyed 41 drugs withdrawn from the Canadian market from 63 to 2004.
That's right. This was not the original intent. I wanted to actually look at some other aspects of drugs that have been withdrawn, but when I sent Health Canada a Freedom of Information request asking for a list of products that have been removed from the market because of safety reasons, the answer that I got back was Health Canada has no such list.
Oh.
The way that Health Canada files information, it's by drug. So this was a sort of a catch-22 situation. They could tell you, if you knew which drugs were withdrawn, they could give you information about why they were withdrawn, when they were withdrawn.
Yeah.
But you had no way of getting the names of the drugs because there was no comprehensive list.
Yeah.
So I used a variety of methods to create that list of 41 different products that I believe had been withdrawn, either ordered off the market by Health Canada or much more commonly removed by the companies, probably after negotiation with the government. Now, you know, that's not an awful lot of drugs compared to the number that are available, but some of the products that have been taken off the market were things that have been available for 30 or 40 years before the seriousness of the side effects were recognized.
Wow.
And other drugs that were removed were ones that had been prescribed to hundreds of thousands or more people per year. So even though small numbers came off the market, the impact of those drugs may have been much, much greater than just the absolute numbers suggest.
We take a short break from our interview. Thank you. You've been listening to Professor Joel Lection explain the Canadian implications of drug safety following from a U.S. study, The Future of Drug Safety by the Institute of Medicine.
The article goes on to mention that drug reactions are not well studied. Is that a facet of the Health Canada report? Interactions as well as reactions.
Yeah, interactions are very difficult to figure out, especially as the population ages and people are taking more and more products. You get up a large percentage of the population that's over 65 or 70 maybe are taking 3-5 different products.
Yeah.
And if there's that raises the possibility for interactions, as the number of drugs you're taking goes up, so does the possibility that you're going to have an interaction. But trying to figure out how those 5 drugs are combining to produce an interaction is something that's extremely difficult. And I don't believe that Health Canada has any money at all to look at interactions in general. And most doctors, again, don't look for that kind of thing. It's
right.
Not something that's emphasized in medical school.
I see.
And you need, there are programs available you can put on palms if you think that something has happened.
Right.
But even those programs are not always completely accurate, and there's also an element of clinical judgment that you have to use to figure out, because not only are you dealing with drugs, but you're dealing with individuals whose biochemistry and physiology, everybody is slightly different. So what may have produced an interaction in an 85-year-old with a variety of medical problems may not have produced an interaction in a 30-year-old who is otherwise healthy.
Yeah.
One of the problems that we have, and the Americans, and in fact, most regulatory agencies, is that the pharmaceutical industry is contributing, well, here in Canada, about 50% of the cost of running the various parts of Health Canada that deal with prescription drugs.
Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah.
How do they contribute?
In the States, it's about the same. In other countries, it's
through what mechanism?
Higher.
Through what mechanism do they contribute?
They pay fees for different things. If you have a submission to get a new drug approved, you pay, I can't remember, I think it's about $175,000 or $180,000.
Right.
For every drug you have on the market, you pay a fee.
Right.
There's a fee that you pay that goes towards the cost of inspecting manufacturing plants to make sure that they're observing high-quality standards.
Mm-hmm.
But that money means that, to a certain extent, that although it's not formal in Canada, there is a quid pro quo,
mm-hmm.
In the sense that the industry is primarily concerned with getting drugs approved faster,
right?
Because that's what makes them money.
Mm.
And Health Canada, to a large extent, has gone along with that
agenda.
With that agenda, and you can see that in terms of the amount of money that goes into approving drugs versus the amount that goes into monitoring drug safety. I and a number of other people have argued that the money to deal with drugs should come out of the public treasury,
mm-hmm.
not from the drug companies. And that recommendation was more or less what was in the Romano report that was reached a couple of years ago. Romano didn't specifically exclude getting money from the drug companies, but he recommended a firewall be
right.
created such that there would be no possibility that the companies could influence the priorities or decisions of the agency. So tying your budget to a certain extent to what you get from the industry can create significant problems.
So addressing this problem for the public in part consists of asking politicians for the solution to it.
It does. Right now, because of the amount of money that comes from the companies and the fact that the approval process is very non-transparent.
Yeah.
There's a perception, whether or not it's true, that that approvals often are done without due regard to evidence around safety and effectiveness. Now
in other words, they're closing the barn door after the horse is bolted.
Yeah. The perception may not be true.
Right.
But you've got circumstances create the conditions for people to become very cynical. So, you know, getting a lot of your money and you're not showing us what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that the only solution to this problem, is more money?
No. I mean, you also need to give Health Canada the authority to require companies to do post-marketing studies, or even better, I would say, is that those studies, the companies can pay for them, but they should be done independently of the companies.
Right.
So that the companies would give money to, oh, maybe something like the Canadian Institutes for Health Research, which would then call for different organizations who want to do this, to do the study, to submit bids, and they would select the organization that they think is best qualified, so that although the drug companies would be paying, they would have nothing to do with the study. So that's one of the things. One of the recommendations in the Institute of Medicine report on the FDA about this five-year renewal, license renewal, is a good idea. That's already being done in the European Union, that at a five-year period, they re-examine the evidence for the drugs.
I see. Who keeps the evidence? Is this filed by physicians, or is this...
No, this is stuff companies are required to submit what are called periodic safety reports. And it depends. I think it's within the first 2 years, you have to do it quarterly, and then from 2 to 5 years, you have to do it every 6 months.
And the license hangs fire at 5 years.
Well, it's not clear how aggressive the regulatory agency in the European Union is going to be in doing these reviews, but there certainly is the possibility that they could be aggressive about it.
So this plan hasn't been enforced for 5 years yet?
I don't believe so.
Yeah, okay. But you think it's a path we could follow?
Yes, and there are a number of other things that you can do. So Health Canada currently has not even bothered to study the effectiveness of the warnings that it posts on its website or the letters that it sends out to doctors about new safety issues. We don't have any idea how effective these things are. They have to start looking at that so that they can come up with strategies to inform people, the public in general, and doctors about emerging safety issues. There are no formal requirements from anybody that the sales representatives who doctors see have to tell them about new safety issues. That could be made a requirement. The ads in medical journals, well, they're better than they were 5 years ago. The detailed safety information is still put in about 8-point print at the back of the journal, far removed from the pictures and the large print.
Yeah.
Although in the U.S., for what it's worth, the detailed information has to be contiguous with the pictures.
Oh, so in the U.S. journal it is.
It's still in small print, and whether or not anybody reads it is another thing, but at least it's easily found.
Okay.
So that can be done. Health Canada could certainly do much more to encourage doctors and the general public to report suspected adverse drug reactions.
Yeah, what could you do to make it worthwhile for physicians to do this?
Well, as I said, I think that doctors should do it because it's part of practicing good medicine.
Yes.
But I think that if you gave them feedback about what they reported, if you made it easy to do the reports. Now, they just have started to allow web-based reporting, but I would guess that most doctors wouldn't know that web-based reporting is allowed or know where the website is.
Right.
So simplifying reporting, I think that the Health Canada should be much more aggressive about talking to doctors about reporting adverse drug reactions. Out of one of the universities in the UK, what they do is they get the names of about the first 10,000 people who get a new drug, and they also get the names of the doctors. And then after a period of time, 6 months or something, they write to these doctors who've written prescriptions and ask them if they've noticed anything unusual in the patients who got the prescriptions.
So the civil service does this as a matter of course?
No, not the civil service. This is done There's a special unit that was originally set up in one of the universities that does this.
Okay.
And we could do that also. With respect for privacy issues, we could set up registries of people who get new drugs, especially vulnerable populations, so elderly people, women who are pregnant, children,
people
who are much more at risk of drug side effects. We could set up registries so that we could monitor, know who got drugs and that we think may pose problems in the future, and then we could monitor what's happening to those people. Are they ending up going to hospital? Is there a higher death rate amongst them?
Mm-hmm.
So that could be done, too.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a number of different things besides just money issues that could be undertaken by, Health Canada specifically, or money could be made available for other things.
So presumably the baby boom, with their numbers, as they age and they come into contact more and more with the medical system, are the ones with the clout to bring this about, but they have to decide that it's important to them.
Yes, they do. It's going to be very interesting because there will be a large number of people taking a lot of drugs in the next 10 or 15 years as the baby boomers go over 65 and start to get the illnesses that are associated more with old age.
Right.
And that may be a big impetus to improve what we've got currently, although I would certainly like to see it before that happens. The government doesn't really seem to want to make this a priority. Some of these issues were raised in a report that was released about 3 years ago now by the Standing Committee of the House of Commons on Health.
Mm-hmm.
They issued a report called Out of the Medicine Cabinet, and they pointed out problems with drug safety, but there didn't seem to be any particular political will to act on what was in that report.
Mm. Maybe when politicians reach that age.
That might be.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate your time, especially out of your personal time in the evening to talk to us about this.
All right. Well, thank you for your interest.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Professor Joel Lection explain the Canadian implications of drug safety following from a U.S. study, The Future of Drug Safety by the Institute of Medicine. In the middle of the show, you heard Mary Lou Williams and Mary's Boogie Woogie. At the break, Albert Ammons. Shout for joy. Thank you. And now Disrespect reviews the news of the past two or three weeks. If you like your news, this is a party. We've got about 20 minutes of it today. For you, the listener, recall these are not the whole stories. These are excerpts from published accounts. For the whole story, you have to go to the media quoted in the broadcast. Opening with the drug safety story, Helen Branswell in the Globe and Mail. Health Canada's approach to drug regulation puts too much emphasis on speeding up approvals, too little on following the safety profile of drugs once they hit the market, according to a new report. Published by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, the report also suggests the law governing drug licensing offers too few tools to the regulatory agency. As a result, it said Health Canada cannot compel a manufacturer to undertake additional safety studies after a drug has been approved, or demand that it alter safety labels on a product. Marc Bertiome, director of the Marketed Pharmaceutical and Medical Devices Bureau, said the figures quoted by Dr. Joel Lexton were out of date when he suggested resources devoted to drug approvals vastly outweighed those directed toward monitoring the safety of drugs once they hit the market. And at www.csnalumni.org, Bill C-51 is now Bill C-6. As expected, Prime Minister Stephen Harper's government reintroduces Bill C-51 for passage in Canadian Parliament. Its new designation is C-6. This is a national issue in Canada. Once Canada is dealt with, the U.S. will have its turn. It's the mentality from the Codex Bunch that is running this, as well as many other platforms that attempt to restrict our freedom as human beings. It's the mentality, the low consciousness, the same one that wants to radiate all almonds, all herbs, erase the practice of millennia of civilization safely and healthily, drinking real milk, use sonar indiscriminately in the oceans, encourage factory farming for pigs, chickens, cows, use and force vaccinations on many groups, including school children and soldiers, encourage cell phone towers and devices all over the place, and so forth. Those of us who feel strongly about any of these issues inform ourselves and are active to one degree or another, not totally realizing that we fractionate ourselves if we don't also realize we're dealing with a single mentality which is allowing all these dangers to exist and proliferate. As you may imagine, I've asked many people involved in this issue many questions. I was part of the Canadian Natural Health Coalition that formed spring 2008 to deal with this problem. My biggest question, who started this? Who is pushing this? Who is running this? Not the organization. Who is the individual, or more likely, who are the individuals running this? What are their names? No one knew. I'm still asking. No one knows. Do you see why this is crucial? Also from the Globe and Mail, Marina Jimenez, poverty may affect memory. Family income has long been a predictor of achievement in life. However, a new study that is creating buzz in the scientific world identifies a biological explanation for poverty, giving new insight into why people who are born poor often stay poor. Poverty, quote, gets into the brain and interferes with achievement, concludes the paper, published last month in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Quote, there are neurological reasons based on stress why people stay poor, said Gary Evans, an environmental and developmental psychologist at Cornell University and the paper's lead author. Stress, in turn, weakens working memories, said Dr. Evans. The paper presents a parallel set of ideas about why poverty is related to deficiencies in cognitive development. Dr. Stephen Huang with the Center for Research on Inner City Health at Toronto St. Michael Hospital says the study shows the biological consequences of poverty. It shows the importance of addressing this issue early on, he said. How can we give children a better start to life? By reducing their stress, we'll improve their working memories. Even a very bright person with an excellent working memory placed in a disadvantaged social situation is likely to do less well in life, he added. And we have the study with us. We'll hold it up to the microphone here, as Paul likes to say, so you can have a better look. It's from http://neuroanthropology.net. It's called Childhood Poverty, Chronic Stress, and Adult Working Memory. The authors are Gary W. Evans and his student, Michelle A. Schamberg. From last Thursday's Star, Joseph Hall and Patty Winsa, staff reporters, poorest families go hungry all day. Study measures depth of poverty in Toronto. Patricia McKenzie has no cable or internet. She doesn't even have a television. She has had to give them up for a far more basic staple, food. An unemployed 38-year-old, McKenzie says she's gone days without eating and has often had to choose between paying the rent and paying for groceries. So the Dawes Road resident likely would find no surprises in a new University of Toronto study that suggests two out of three families in the city's lowest income neighborhoods are unable to get even enough to eat. And 28% of those were in a category that we would call severe food insecurity, says study co-author Sharon Kirkpatrick, who helped conduct the research as part of her U of T doctoral thesis. What this study is really showing is that even though we have lots of food programs available in our communities, like food banks, there's still a great deal of unmet need, Kirkpatrick says. This really points to the need to address the roots of the problem. It's not a food problem, it's a poverty problem. Editorial in the Star, Strengthen Poverty Bill. Children's Minister Deb Matthews, who designed the province's anti-poverty strategy, states, quote, the only way we're ever going to succeed in the fight against poverty is for it to become a core responsibility of governments now and in the future. Political interests in governments come and go, so the anti-poverty bill, now before a legislative committee, would be a tool to hold politicians to account. Right now, though, the bill falls short of that objective. It requires public consultation only according to the minister's whim, annual reports to be released on a website, and a review of the overall poverty reduction strategy at least every 5 years to be conducted by the government itself. As one anti-poverty advocate puts it, I don't think we can trust any government to give a frank assessment of their own efforts. Underscoring that point, Conservative MPPs last month rose in the legislature during second reading debate in the bill to declare that past Premier Mike Harris had done the most for Ontario's poor. He lifted 257,000 Ontarians out of poverty by providing hope and opportunity, they said. The booming economy did that. While Harris can take some credit for the economy, he also slashed welfare rates by 22%, thereby relegating those who couldn't find work to even deeper poverty. It's heartening, therefore, that those same Conservative MPPs have joined the New Democrats in calling for an amendment to the anti-poverty bill to require an independent 5-year review. More tools for public accountability could also be included in the legislation, which is now undergoing public hearings, but ultimately it's up to Ontarians to ensure that this government and its successors stay the course and end the scourge of poverty. In the Star, from Laurie Monsebraten. Activists push poverty-free legislation. Ontario's proposed poverty reduction legislation should be strengthened to include the goal of achieving a poverty-free province for everyone, activists say. It's not adequate to only reduce poverty, said Sarah Blackstock of the 25 and 5 Network for Poverty Reduction. The purpose of poverty reduction strategies must be to create a poverty-free Ontario, and the bill should explicitly say that. If that's not the goal, why are we doing this? The Globe and Mail, Crime, by Jane Armstrong in Vancouver. To friends, Michael Nesterik was a man with enormous natural gifts who was obsessed with turning his life around so he could be a better father, and he nearly succeeded. Even former Mayor Sam Sullivan was drawn to help the engaging, well-spoken man who wheeled his chair around downtown Vancouver with the precision of an athlete and spoke endlessly of his daughters, but whose life was marred by drugs and injuries. By his late 30s, Nesterik was addicted to hard drugs, homeless, and had lost a leg. Despite repeated hard-fought battles to get clean, Mr. Nesterik's life ended on the street. His body was found near the front steps of an East End elementary school, his wheelchair nearby. Police have ruled his death a homicide, but say they have no motive or suspects in the disturbing case. The death has struck a nerve in the city, which is preparing to host the Winter Olympics next year, but whose reputation is slumping from a rash of gang-related shootings. It came less than a week after a high-profile community activist was killed while out for an afternoon jog. When police released his name last weekend, they described Mr. Nesterik, 41, as a homeless, vulnerable, one-legged man. But those who knew him describe a charismatic, fiercely determined person who, as recently as a few weeks ago, was making valiant efforts to get off the street. And now let's take a break for Michael Nesterik with Kenny Blues' Boss Wayne, the Burrard Street Boogie Blues. From the Star, Jason Miller, staff reporter. As homeless survey begins, advocates call for action. As 1,000 volunteers set out to conduct Toronto's second street needs survey, a national advocacy group is calling for sweeping changes to curtail homelessness, sustainable housing, and a comprehensive national strategy to tackle underlying causes are among the measures the Canadian Housing and Renewal Association plans to push for. Jeffrey Gillard, a spokesman for the Social Housing Group, said the plan is to help all levels of government stem homelessness, not merely manage it. This from the Caledon Institute of Social Policy, Tuesday, April 21st, Toronto Star. This institution, by the way, turned us away for calling back too many times after leaving a voicemail and not getting an answer. This is by Michael Mendelson, Ken Battle, and Sherry Torman. An additional 41,000 Canadians were out of work this March, bringing unemployment close to 1.5 million. This frightening number will almost certainly keep climbing in the next several months. In the 1982 recession, jobless benefits helped 76% of the unemployed. During the 1990 recession, fully 83% received benefits. Today, coverage is down to 43%, half of what it was in 1990. Only 1 in 3 of the unemployed in Ontario and the West receive employment insurance, compared to 8 in 10 in Quebec and the Atlantic provinces. The East-West gap in coverage is just as great if we compare cities. For example, just 24% of the unemployed in Toronto got benefits in 2008, compared to 50% in St. John's. The decimation of employment insurance has its roots in Ottawa's belt tightening in the 1990s. The calculation of weekly benefits includes weeks not worked or only worked part-time before a claim, so a few weeks with low earnings can dramatically reduce average earnings over the 26-week period. The formula discriminates against workers, typically women, with unstable earnings patterns because they work on call in casual or temporary work. The amount of benefit should be calculated on the best 12 weeks of earnings of the previous 26 so as to allow flexibility to take part-time jobs. Such measures would strengthen employment insurance but would still leave many unemployed without coverage. Here's a bold new idea. Ottawa should create a new program to complement a stronger employment insurance system. The new scheme would pay temporary and time-limited benefits to unemployed workers with lower modest incomes who cannot qualify for employment insurance. The new program would prevent tens of thousands of the unemployed from falling onto job-destroying provincial welfare rolls. Just as we did during the 1930s, the Great Recession of 2009 can be an opportunity to reconstruct our social programs so that we come out of this crisis with a stronger social safety net, better adapted to the realities of a 21st century economy. Toronto Star, Tuesday, April 14th. Mental toll on soldiers skyrockets. More than one in five returning from Afghanistan suffer psychiatric problems, documents show. Alan Woods, the Ottawa Bureau of the Star. More than one in five Canadian soldiers and police officers deployed to Afghanistan leave the force with post-traumatic stress or other psychiatric problems, and that figure is rapidly rising, the Toronto Star has learned. By the end of last month, the numbers of soldiers and police officers discharged from the military and RCMP for psychological strain after tours in Afghanistan had reached 1,053, representing an increase of more than 50% from 2008, a spokesperson for Veterans Affairs Canada told the Star. The increase had been predicted in documents released under the Access to Information Act. They'd revealed that as of April 2008, 700 Canadian soldiers and Mounties who had served on the Afghan front lines, 19% of all forces deployed, had qualified for medical release from the Canadian Forces or RCMP with a pensionable psychiatric condition, but warned of a dramatic hike in those numbers. The government spokesperson, Janice Summerby, stressed that there's no way to know whether a psychiatric condition is a direct result of Canada's participation in the Afghan war or whether it stems from earlier deployments around the globe. But the documents say that longer, multiple, and more dangerous deployments have led to an increase in the prevalence of operational stress injuries among the members of these organizations. Also from the Toronto Star, polls seek mysterious OPP report into fatal tasering. Sikansky inquiry learns of document. Vancouver, Petty Fong, Western Canada Bureau Chief. The Polish government is calling for the release of a mysterious report prepared by the Ontario Provincial Police into the RCMP's conduct in the death of Polish immigrant Robert Sikansky. Don Rosenblum, the lawyer representing the Republic of Poland at a public inquiry, said he didn't learn about the report's existence until a little while ago. Sikansky died October 14, 2007, after an RCMP officer jolted him several times with a taser during a confrontation with four Mounties at the Vancouver airport. The inquiry into the Polish man's death began on January 19th. Rosenblum said he doesn't know if the OPP report is a review of the investigation conducted by the RCMP or a separate report into the incident. He first learned about the existence of the OPP's involvement after looking at transcripts and seeing a senior RCMP officer in BC mention that the outside police force was involved. I don't know what it is until we all see it, and it can be presented to us, said Rosenblum. Commission Chair Thomas Braidwood, a retired judge, has not made a decision at the time of going to press whether the report from the OPP can be released. Across the pond, officer questioned about G20 attack. A London policeman has been questioned on suspicion of manslaughter over a man's death at group of 20 summit protests this month after it was found he died of a hemorrhage, not a heart attack. Ian Tomlinson, 47, was filmed being hit by a police officer with a baton on April 1st, minutes before collapsing. He had not been taking part in the protests, which lasted 2 days and were marred by spells of violence. His death raised concern about the tactics deployed by police to contain the protesters and was followed by scores of complaints alleging police brutality at the demonstrations. It was revealed that the results of initial post-mortem examination, which found the man had suffered a heart attack, had been overturned by a second examination. This in the Post via Agence France-Presse. And on a subject close to our hearts, from actually going to look closer at it next week, The Star, parents want sick kids taken to Rights Tribunal, Emily Mathieu, staff reporter. The parents of Annie Farlow, a two-month-old who died at the Hospital for Sick Children in 2005 after receiving what her parents allege was inadequate care because of a genetic condition, are attempting to take their case to the Human Rights Tribunal of Ontario. I think every child, regardless of their disabilities, deserves a chance at life. And if the treatment or surgery is not in their best interest, then they deserve a dignified, comfortable, and peaceful death, said Annie's mother, Barb Farlow, outside a meeting to determine if their application for a hearing will go forward. Annie had trisomy 13, a genetic condition associated with severe developmental and physical disabilities. The Farlows raised concerns that the hospital has a policy to provide children with genetic conditions only supportive care, keeping them comfortable until they die rather than attempt extraordinary life-saving measures. The Farlows also said the hospital is reluctant to release crucial records related to Annie's care, including an audit detailing the period of time close to her death. Yes, lawyers for sick kids and for the physicians who treated Annie attempted to dismiss the Farlows' application because, in part, it was filed later than time guidelines set out by the tribunal. In August 2005, Annie was brought to Sick Kids in Distress. She died 24 hours later. Her parents said a do not resuscitate order was issued without consent. The Farlows say this is not about pointing fingers. We have always felt it was a systemic issue. We hoped we would reach that immediate and collaborative solution. A decision on the hearing is expected next month. And again, reflecting next week's interview, from The Star, Stuart Laidlaw, faith and ethics reporter, dead when the doctor says you are. Ethicists wrestle with the changing nature and timing of death. Dead is dead, except when it's not. Death used to be a little more self-evident, says Kerry Bowman, a medical ethicist specializing in end-of-life issues at the University of Toronto's Joint Center for Bioethics. Today, you're dead when the doctor says you are. Deciding when somebody is dead or about to die is quickly emerging as one of the top ethical issues in medicine today, as technology makes it increasingly possible to keep people alive who would otherwise have died not so long ago. The technology has far outstripped the ethics, says Tim Falconer, author of That Good Night, Ethicists, Euthanasia, and End-of-Life Care. Feeding tubes and ventilators weren't designed to keep people alive for 15 years, but that's what they're being used for. And just last week in Toronto, the debate began again with the case of two-month-old Kaylee Vitelli at the Hospital for Sick Children, whose parents were told she could not live without a respirator and wanted to donate her heart to another baby at the hospital. But Kaylee kept breathing, forcing all those involved to question their assumptions about her seeming impending death. Yesterday, she was continuing to breathe with oxygen assistance. This little girl just wasn't ready to die, says Maura McQueen, director of the Canadian Catholic Bioethics Institute. McQueen worries about a blurring of the line between dying and dead, saying we sometimes treat people as already dead once they're deemed terminal, a notion Kaylee challenged with her survival. Organ donations most often take place after brain death, a concept articulated 40 years ago at Harvard University and meaning the irreversible end of all brain activity. In a brain-dead patient, the brain no longer tells the body to keep living, so machines do that instead. Brain-dead soon came to replace the historic understanding of death, the heart stopping. After all, a stopped heart no longer seemed relevant when machines could keep a heart beating indefinitely. However, the increased popularity of donation after cardiac death, or the harvesting of organs from patients whose hearts have all been allowed to stop beating, has once again got the medical community looking at how to define death, according to the functions of the heart. If a heart is restarted, the person from whom it was taken cannot have been dead, according to cardiac criteria, wrote Robert Veach, professor of medical ethics at the Kennedy Institute of Ethics at Georgetown University. In such a case, Veach writes, death was caused by the donation of the heart, not its stopping. Such quandaries make donation after cardiac death very problematic for many people. In recent months, even the long-held acceptance of brain death has been called into question, particularly in the Catholic Church. The Vatican newspaper questioned last summer whether brain death violates traditional Catholic teaching by equating human life with brain activity only. It pointed the case of a brain-dead pregnant woman who was able to give birth to her child. McQueen says the column did not shake Vatican support for the brain death definition, adding she draws a distinction between, quote, being alive and, quote, being kept alive by machines. When cases like that of Kaylee come along and capture the public imagination, Falconer says, it unleashes a debate about death and dying. This is a discussion we need to have. And from the Globe, Tuesday, April 21st. After Boston's success, amputee to take run at games. A Canadian amputee runner won his personal challenge on Monday, and with it a division of the Boston Marathon. Rick Ball of Orillia, Ontario, won't get the publicity that has engulfed Ethiopia's Dariba Murga, who finished first among the male runners, or Kenya's Selena Kosgei, who won the women's race. But the 43-year-old left-leg amputee was the fastest in his class, setting a personal best record of 3 hours, 1 minute, 50 seconds, only 2 years after taking up training to run the classic marathon distance. My ultimate goal is to run at the Paralympic Games in London, Mr. Ball explained in a Facebook entry. As soon as I started running 2 years ago, I got this crazy idea about Boston. And also from the Star, Canadian Press, quadriplegic lawyer makes historic trek to the North Pole. Thunder Bay. A Thunder Bay man has become the first known quadriplegic to reach the North Pole. David Shannon, 46, who was paralyzed after a spinal cord injury, reached the frosty destination on Saturday with his expedition partner, Christopher Watkins, 40, who is also from Thunder Bay. The men, both lawyers, say they embarked on the daunting trek to raise awareness of accessibility issues and to show how obstacles can be overcome through persistence. Thank you for selecting Disrespect for your entertainment. That's all we have this week. Come back next week. We have an interesting story about the children who are dying at SickKids. You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.mcmaster.ca. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.